It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, Americans are less willing to move to find a new job than we used to be. We'll find out why and how it's affecting communities.
First, the Affordable Care Act is about to enter its fifth enrollment season, even with Republican efforts to repeal the health care law. This will be the first time the sign-up period for insurers will take place under a presidential administration that's been hostile to Obamacare.
Amy Goldstein is a health policy reporter at The Washington Post and the author of the new book, Janesville, An American Story. She's written about the uncertain enrollment season for the Affordable Care Act. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, Amy, one thing President Trump has said, maybe instead of Republicans repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, maybe the administration could simply let the Affordable Care Act collapse. So with that as a backdrop, what do we know about what could be expected in this next upcoming enrollment season starting November 1st?
Well, one thing that we know that's absolutely clear is that the enrollment period, as you say, this is the fifth year for Affordable Care Act health plans to have people sign up for them. The enrollment period this time is going to start on November 1st, and it's going to last for just 45 days until December 15th. That's about half as long as it's lasted the last 3 years. So we know that the enrollment period is happening. But there are a lot of decisions that were made by the prior administration, by the Obama administration, which obviously was a big, big supporter of the Affordable Care Act, that haven't yet been made by their successors. And there are things like what kind of notices, if any, is the federal government going to send to people who already have health plans in the Affordable Care Act marketplaces? Are there going to be grants given out again to groups and communities around the country called navigators who work with consumers who might need a little bit of advice in how to sign up for coverage? We don't know whether there are going to be contracts given out again for federal call centers for people to be able to call in and ask questions. So there are those and a whole bunch of other things that are just not clear yet.
And then there's the messaging and how that might affect the markets either directly or indirectly. The president hasn't given a clear indication, and it sounds as though the Health and Human Services has had very little to say about this. What do we know about the messaging and how that could affect things?
Well, my sense is that, from the reporting I've done, is that there's different messaging in different places within this administration. So the president himself obviously has been quite outspoken, both in statements he's made, speeches he's given, and in his tweets, that the marketplaces, as he says it, are dead, that they should be allowed to collapse under their own weight. He's held several photo opportunities in the last few months with Americans he calls Obamacare victims. So he's been a big naysayer of this whole idea of signing up for ACA coverage, Affordable Care Act coverage. On the other hand, if you go down way into the deeper layers of the Department of Health and Human Services, where there are career staff whose jobs it has been to carry out the marketplace enrollment periods and give out this federal money and set policy, they are apparently working more as they always have. In June, there was an annual conference, as they've been the last 4 years, for people who and organizations that have served as these so-called navigators, these assisters in helping people to enroll. And the navigators who attended this meeting were told, you know, we'll get you the contracts that you've had. Whether that's true or not, we won't know yet for another several weeks when they usually go out.
And you touched on a handful of the big questions, and among the biggest is subsidies. And President Trump has said maybe those subsidies would be withdrawn for low-income Americans, and that could be a bargaining chip to move the Republican health care agenda forward. So what is the likelihood that those subsidies will not be there?
Well, there are two main kinds of subsidies under the health care law. And the one that the president's not talking about affecting, at least not at the moment, are subsidies for people to help them afford their health plans premiums. And about 85% of the Americans with Affordable Care Act coverage get those kinds of subsidies. The kind that President Trump is talking about are so-called cost-sharing reduction payments. And those are subsidies that are paid to insurance companies on behalf of lower-income people with these ACA health plans to help them afford their health plans' deductibles and out-of-pocket expenses of other kinds. And the president has, you know, tweeted a few times pretty vehemently that he'd like to get rid of, he calls them bailouts. I mean, they're not really bailouts, but they're payments to insurers. A couple of his top aides said a little more than a week ago that last week President Trump was going to make a decision, and no decisions happened. So it's hard to tell when something may or may not take place to change those subsidies.
And if insurance companies don't, in fact, get those subsidies, does that make them more likely to leave the marketplace?
Well, it makes them either more likely to leave the marketplaces, or pretty much all the insurers have said that without these subsidies, they would have to raise their rates. And it's been kind of a complicated situation from state to state, because in some states, the insurance regulators, which every state has, the regulators have told the insurers to submit two different sets of prices that they would charge if those subsidies were to happen or not. Other states have just made the judgment, you know, we'll assume that they're going to take place, or we'll assume that they're not going to take place. So it's really kind of a checkerboard as to how states and insurers have been reacting to this uncertainty this late in the season about these subsidies.
We're talking with Amy Goldstein right now, health policy reporter at The Washington Post. She's also got a new book out called Janesville, An American Story. And we're talking now about uncertainty in the health insurance market as enrollment season begins for the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And looking at recent cuts, two big Affordable Care Act contract cuts that took place last month, do you see those, Amy, as being a harbinger of what could happen next? More cuts coming like that?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Let me tell you a little bit about these contracts. These were two companies that for the last 3 or 4 years have been operating in 18 cities to help with enrollment in the ACA marketplaces. They were having health insurance fairs. They were going into public libraries and setting up tables and setting up balloons and trying to attract attention. And they were basically doing work to help people understand how to choose insurance, how to sign up for the subsidies that the law allows people in most cases. And just in the last few weeks, each of these companies was notified kind of out of the blue that their contracts were not going to be renewed for another year. You know, it's a big question whether that's, you know, an indicator of what's coming up or whether it was just an isolated set of decisions for those two companies.
I want to talk a little bit about what you're seeing from states. Now, each state seems to have taken, you know, a slightly tailored approach to the way that they integrate the Affordable Care Act and the marketplaces. Wisconsin has one, California another. What kind of uncertainty is this causing at the state level?
Well, there are a couple kind of uncertainties, and they're a little bit broader in some cases than what's going to happen in the marketplace. With all the talk in Congress with Republican plans that would get rid of expansion of Medicaid that the health care law has brought about, Wisconsin is not one of the states that expanded Medicaid under the law. But there are about 31 states that have. And the governors and state legislators in those states, including ones led by Republicans, have been pretty anxious that they would be in bad shape with their budgets if those subsidies were for the extra federal money that's gone along for the expansion of Medicaid were to go away. So that's one big uncertainty. In terms of the marketplaces themselves, I mean, there are these questions about how many insurers are going to participate. If the cost-sharing reductions we've been talking about were to be ended, it's possible that some insurers could go away. Under the annual contracts that insurers sign with the federal government in states that rely on the federal marketplace, healthcare.gov, those contracts would let the insurers drop out of those marketplaces not just next year, but immediately if they wanted to. Now, this is all hypothetical. No one knows what's going to happen, but it's a big source of who knows what's going to happen.
And, Amy, what about someone right now who is on the exchanges? They have a plan through the exchanges. there's so much uncertainty at the federal level, bleeding down to the state level. Do you need to look out for yourself? Do you need to make alternate plans? Do you need to, I mean, can you rely on someone in your state to call you up and say, hey, the enrollment period is shorter, your insurer, I don't know, might go away? That's a big hypothetical on that, but what do people need to know?
Well, it would be good for people to start doing their own research. For people who already are in marketplace health plans, one consideration is that every year up in the last 3 years, notices have been sent out saying, we, the government, could re-enroll you automatically if you'd like us to do that, but your prices in your for your insurance that you have now might be going up. So it really might be a good idea for you to look and see what alternatives you have and then make a good decision for yourself. Those notices in the past have tended to go out by December 15th. Well, this year, December 15th is going to be the end of the enrollment period. And we don't know yet whether those notices are going to be sent out at all, and if so, when. So for people who currently have an ACA health plan, it might be a really good idea for them to start to research on their own what will be happening to the prices of their health plans and whether they have any alternatives.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to do it.
That was Amy Goldstein, a health policy reporter at The Washington Post and the author of the new book, Janesville, An American Story, joining us there to talk about uncertainty in the health insurance market as enrollment season begins for the Affordable Care Act.
Right now, the United States has seen over 80 straight months of job growth, the longest streak on record, and the unemployment rate has been falling since the Great Recession, but the good news hasn't been shared by everyone.
There are still pockets of high unemployment, including some rural areas and so-called Rust Belt communities where manufacturing jobs have left and not been replaced. In recent comments to the Wall Street Journal, President Trump raised a solution. Americans, quote, are going to have to start moving. But data shows that Americans are less likely to move in search of work than they used to be.
Heather Long is a Washington Post economics correspondent where she's covered the issue of job mobility. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, it's a really important issue.
Well, how willing are we Americans to pick up and move to find work?
Not very willing anymore. So it's been cut in half, our willingness to get up and literally move houses, whether it's move houses across town or move houses to the other side of the country. Our grandparents' generation, so if for much of the 50s, 60s, 70s, they were two times as likely to do that than we are today.
And this is historically a huge part of the American economy. People might up stakes to move to mine gold in California or start a farm in Wisconsin, you name it. This has been a big deal for our economy over the years, hasn't it?
Exactly. It feels like it's ingrained and in fundamental part of who we are as Americans. Many of us have stories of how our ancestors came to this country from overseas. And as you said, and then once they got here, they were also continuing to migrate. So it's really baffled both economists and demographers and cultural historians about why there's been just this marked decline. I mean, literally, you take your pencil in 1985 and it's just been a straight line decline down to where we are today with people not being willing to move.
We'll get into some of the reasons that may be causing that. But first, how big an obstacle is this to the economy if we've got pools of workers and pools of jobs and we can't get them in the same place?
Right. It holds back growth and it holds back wages. I mean, it's a problem for everybody in the sense that on a national level, we want to get our best people and our best workers to where they can thrive and where they can get better wages and where they can make more stuff. And that helps the economy grow, which helps the country and should then help all of us. So it's on a lot of levels, it's not great for the economy at the moment.
We're talking to Heather Long, Washington Post economics correspondent, about our willingness to move to get a job in the United States, that willingness going down substantially over the decades, over the years. Let's get into some of the reasons why. You talked to different economists and experts and looked at reports on this. One of the reasons people point to is housing costs from where they are now to where they might go to get a job. How does that play into this?
It's a huge a factor. And that was actually something when the president, what got me interested in writing about this topic recently was when President Trump made those remarks to the Journal. And it's funny because his sort of, you know how he is, he made this offhanded comment after he said people should just get up and move. He said, well, you know, if you've got a $70,000 home and now it's worth nothing because people are moving out of your area, you should just give up, you know, and move, like just count it as a loss. And so I think realistically, obviously, for many Americans, that's not how you operate. You don't just write one house off and go move to your Mar-a-Lago, your other house. You have a fundamental problem where, A, you can't sell your property for a decent amount where you currently are, and, B, if you were to move to where the jobs are hot, let's say a San Francisco or a New York City or even in Atlanta, that's going to double or triple your property costs.
What would be a way to overcome that obstacle? I mean, that, you know, moving from that underwater house in, say, I don't know, Flint, Michigan, to a hot market like you were mentioning, Portland or San Francisco or something like that, where jobs are. How could we help people do that?
Yeah. That's sort of the million, if not billion-dollar question that you've hit on. There's a couple of things. On a very basic level, there's been a huge outcry at the moment about why companies won't pay workers more. So it would help everybody a lot if people, when either in their current location or where they would be moving to, if those wages would start to rise. And so even though jobs are very plentiful right now, the unemployment rate is low, there's this ongoing mystery in the economy about why wages aren't going up. So that's kind of 101. Why aren't people getting paid more? You know, there's other theories of how you could help people. There's debates about, at the moment, there actually is a tax credit to help people move. So there's debates about whether we could have more government help or have more companies. Some companies are willing to give relocation assistance. So if these CEOs keep complaining, I can't get the workers I want, well, again, they could help to pay some of those transition costs for people. So there's also, I actually just published an article today on this topic, there's been a growth in the rental market. So companies on Wall Street went around after the financial crisis and bought up a bunch of single-family homes in a lot of major urban areas, and they are now renting those out. So that's supposed to be kind of another change that, all right, you may used to have owned your home where you are in different parts of the country, and now maybe you have to rent.
Moving on from housing costs, sometimes moving runs up against other American traditions like connection to family, connection to a local community. Is that something that seems to be rooting us in place, maybe at the expense of a better paying job or a job, period?
That's a huge one, and it's something that I heard over and over again, and the Wall Street Journal, give them credit. They also did a really great piece on this month as well. And I, you know, as an economist, I always think of the numbers and the money first, but you're right. Those intangible factors, those factors of friends and family, are when you actually get out and talk to people on the ground, that is far more important to them than the numbers. I was out at a GM General Motors plant that was closing, eliminating an entire shift earlier this year in Ohio, and I said a lot of the workers I met were in their 20s, 30s. I said, hey, you're young. Why don't you just move to another part of the country? You could even work at a GM factory in another part of the country. Why don't you just up and go? And consistently over and over again, people said, well, I'm divorced. I might not be able to see my kids if I moved. Or somebody said, hey, I'm taking care of my sick uncle. Other people really talked about how important their church community or their other kind of dug-in networks were, and they didn't want to lose those.
You also talk about a cultural divide. We've talked about this here in Wisconsin, between rural areas, small towns, and big cities. And if it's the case that there's not enough employment in that smaller community, the jobs are in the big city, some people are suspicious that's a place they don't want to live. They don't feel like they'd fit in there.
Yes, you're exactly right. It's another one of these big cultural issues. I'll never forget, I was in Appalachia in eastern Kentucky earlier this year, and a woman said to me, honey, I'm just country to the core. You know, she didn't want to move even to a Lexington, Kentucky. That just, she preferred to be in the mountain areas of Kentucky. She just really felt like the land called to her. That was her people, her place. And even though she knew she could be probably be better off if she moved elsewhere. So I think that is a factor. That the Wall Street Journal article, I was really struck. They followed a young woman who had a full scholarship to a university to be a swimmer, and you know, she just kept saying over and over again she would go and she would try other places, tried to go off to university, ended up coming back home, tried to go somewhere else, ended up coming back home. And basically, she didn't say it in quite these words, but I'll translate it. This is how I've been sharing it to people, and that is, she said, look, I just don't want to live in a godless place where people are willing to have sex with strangers, but they won't talk to their neighbors.
Right. And I think there's a portion of our audience maybe laughing at that. And there's a portion listening right now who are nodding their heads in agreement. This cultural divide is a serious economic problem.
Yes, I agree. I think it plays in a deeper role than people realize what's going on. And I don't know how we overcome that. Again, the easy answer, the economic answer, is we just pay people more. And if you're an economist, you sit there and say, well, no matter what, there's a price that somebody will be willing to move or will be willing to make that transition. But I think people are underestimating how high that threshold needs to be. And right now, we're not anywhere near close.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Heather, it seems like some of the people you talk to and others have talked to are hoping that jobs will come back to their community. A manufacturing plant will open. Even as manufacturing might come back, it might not come back to the same places, right?
I'm so glad you made that point. I was flooded with emails after this story came out. It gets people talking. Should we be moving more? Why aren't we moving as much as our grandparents? And that's the third question I would get over and over again, is just what you said. Well, isn't the other solution that we just bring the companies to where the workers are? And that's a really big conundrum as well. Some CEOs complain that they go into certain areas, and if there aren't a huge pool of workers, they run the risk that the workers that are there, that some of them may become alcoholics or addicted to drugs, and that has really reduced their pool when they've gone into some rural areas.
I'm sorry, I asked a big question right at the end. Thanks, Heather Long, for joining us today, Washington Post economics columnist.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
First summer just has a month or so to go, but it's not over yet. And even if it were over, it's never too late to talk about today's Food Friday topic, ice cream.
Not just any ice cream, though. We're looking at Mexican ice cream this week. That includes dairy-based frozen treats, sorbets, and all the sweet, spicy, and savory toppings that go along with them.
Fani Gerson is a chef and nationally known expert on Mexican sweets. Her new cookbook is called Mexican Ice Cream, Beloved Recipes and Stories. Fani, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, the history you write of Mexican ice cream goes really far back. Could you tell us the origins?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be talking about Mexican ice cream with you. And so the first ice creams of Mexico, not ice creams per se, but the first frozen treats, date way back when the Spaniards arrived to Mexico. And so they would gather snow from the top of two volcanoes that are near, they're in the center of Mexico, very close to Mexico City, called Iztaccíhuatl and Popocatépetl. And they would collect this ice and would bring it down. Of course, they had many different ways of insulating them. And they would then press like natural fruits, because they're all abundant in Mexico. And they would use they would mix it together in a kind of shaved ice, rustic kind of way. But this was definitely a treat for, you know, people in power. And, it wasn't until much later on that it was available, any kind of frozen treat, to everybody in Mexico.
You tell this wonderful, wonderful story at the beginning of your book about searching for a little town where you'd gotten a tip that they had really good ice cream there. And you kind of just went and sniffed it out and spent all day sampling ice cream. Can you tell us about that and what was so special about it?
This was amazing. So when I had my first job as a pastry chef in a restaurant here called Rosa Mexicano in New York, and I went to Mexico to wait for my visa, and I really wanted to, you know, do research and find about old recipes and trying to give them a modern twist. And then I kept asking everybody, you know, if they knew of something that was really special or a book or anything. And my aunt heard from a colleague of hers, she was a teacher, that there's this little town in the outskirts of Mexico City. You know, it's like, there's an ice cream town. I'm like, what do you mean there's an ice cream town? And it's been here in my backyard my whole life. What are you talking about? And so she didn't have any address or anything. And that's very common in Mexico. It's like, oh, you just go around there and you ask. Now, it wasn't really a town per se. It's really between two towns. It was a highway. And it's just, you know, several blocks long. And there's these wooden buckets with cylinders inside and ice that's sort of in between each of them. This is a type of ice cream, very traditional in Mexico, called nieve de garrafa. Garrafa is the name of the cylinder. And you have all of these just colorful signs with very poetic names. And my sister was there. So my aunt and I were there. And we just spent like half of the day just searching for the place. And then the other half just eating as much ice cream as we could. And that was an experience that really changed my life, you know, without knowing it at the time.
So you've gone treasure hunting for ice cream. You've written now about Mexican ice cream. What is it that makes Mexican ice cream unique?
I think that two things that really stand out to me, I mean, there's many things, but two things that really stand out is that method that I was briefly describing before, the of hand paddling, is still made in many places in Mexico. Like, this is very much a family tradition. It's part of an oral tradition that's passed down from generation to generation, and people make them all around Mexico. And that makes it very, very special. This is kind of ice cream that you can't, you know, doesn't hold for another day. You know, you have to eat it that day. So they make it, and it takes a really long time. And the second thing is the regionality. So in Mexico, food is extremely regional. But I don't think that people, even in Mexico, sometimes realize how diverse it is and how specific. So there's certain flavors that you can only find not only in a specific state, but in a little town of a little city of a specific state. And that, you know, is often because you can't find a specific fruit that, you know, it just doesn't grow somewhere else. And some others are specific flavors that just wouldn't sell somewhere else. So I think those are two things that really stand out for me. And if I could just add one more, it's sort of, you know, if you go to an ice cream shop in the States, for example, or in a lot of places in Europe, you're going to find a very small selection of sorbets. And in Mexico, it's the opposite. You have, you know, at least half of them, and in some cases even more sorbet selection. So that's really, you know, it's not an afterthought, you know, and often it feels like in a lot of places they have sorbet just because they have to have an option that's dairy free. But in Mexico, like, I can tell you, anytime I go to an ice cream shop, I always get sorbet.
We're talking to Fani Gerson right now, chef and nationally renowned expert on Mexican sweets. And her new cookbook is called Mexican Ice Cream, Beloved Recipes and Stories. And Fani, I just finally tried this place my family has been raving about. It's a Mexican ice cream shop in Madison, Wisconsin. And some of the things that struck me, and you see this in your book as well, is the flavors. Different flavors. You've got chili and mango. You've got avocado. You've got chamoy, and also cheese. So can you tell us about sort of the range of the different flavors that you're going to find?
Yeah. I mean, what's the name of that?
La Michoacán.
La Michoacán. Yes. I was going to guess. That's the most common name. Yeah, the array of flavors is really impressive. I mean, I think... because of the abundance of fruit, like fruit is definitely plays a big part about, you know, in flavors in Mexican ice cream. You know, you have from tamarind to mango, guava, you know, and there's a lot of seasonal fruits that, you know, in the same way that you can't find them in the market, you won't find them in the ice cream. But you also have like cheese, and some of the cheeses, for example, you know, in the Yucatan area, they have queso de bola, which is like a Hollandaise cheese, like a Gouda. And you can only find it there. And that's very, you know, it's more savory. But in other parts, you have, you know, more like a queso fresco, which is a ricotta type cheese. And we definitely love our spice and our citrus elements. And that, you know, ice cream is no exception. So a lot of places is not even just about the flavor of the ice cream, but how it's served. So there, you'll often find stands that have, you know, cups that have chili in the bottom and in the edges, for you to scoop whichever flavor you want. And then even in some places, they squeeze lime over it. So it's definitely, you know, not just vanilla and chocolate that you'll find.
Well, Fani, let's get into making this at home. And I'm looking at pictures in your book right now of people stirring this by hand with big paddles and huge buckets. Your recipes call for just the standard ice cream maker we can have at home. First of all, does it come out as good if I make it in my ice cream maker at home versus, you know, paddling it all morning in that big bucket?
Yeah, you know, it's actually funny because it comes very close to it, because a lot of the home machines, you know, they're not very fast. They're not like professional machines. Professional machines, you know, you can avoid, you know, crystallization and things like that because they freeze very fast and they add a lot of air. So the machines that you get at home, for the most part, kind of mimic what you would do at hand, you know, by hand. So it's pretty close.
And you talk about, going back to your love of sorbet, you said you could have written an entire book about sorbet. So
yes.
Let's start with a sorbet since you love it so much. You gave us a recipe, deviled mango sorbet. Can you talk us through it?
Yeah. Well, I don't have the recipe in front of me, unfortunately, but it's really about the ripe mangoes. You know, it's about choosing the mangoes, and there's many different varieties. And what makes it deviled is the spiciness of it. So, you know, it's really, you know, you have a very ripe mango. You put a little bit of lime or lemon to really heighten. And then it has the chili.
That sounds great.
We're talking to Chef Fani Gerson about making Mexican ice cream on today's edition of Food Friday. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you've tried making your own ice cream or sorbets at home. What works for you? Do you use any Mexican ice cream recipes? Have you tried these different flavors that Fani's talking about? Have you been to a Mexican ice cream shop or eaten ice cream in Mexico yourself? And if you need some advice on making ice cream at home or sorbet, call in now. We've got answers, I think, or Fani does. I don't. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up the conversation with Chef Fani Gerson about Mexican ice cream. And she's the author of the book, Mexican Ice Cream, Beloved Recipes and Stories.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you make your own ice cream, popsicles, or sorbets at home? Have you used some of these Mexican-style flavors, chilies, sour cream maybe to make the frozen treats? Do you need tips for toppings or using seasonal ingredients for your ice cream? Just some advice on ice cream making in general. Fani is here to help. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Ken joining us in Madison. Ken, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I was just wondering. I had probably a pretty simple question here. I was wondering about when I think of Mexican ice cream, I always thought of like fried ice cream because that's what I see in restaurants around town here. But the things that you're describing sound a lot more exotic. So I was kind of wondering, how does fried ice cream fit into all of this? And where can I taste some of these delicious sounding treats locally here?
All right, Kent, thank you for that. And Fani.
Well, thank you, Ken, for your question. Actually, I have to tell you that in Mexico, we do not have a fried ice cream. So I don't know where that came from. And I didn't learn about fried ice cream in Mexican restaurants until I moved to the States. And so I thought when I did the research for the book, I said, well, maybe it has a root somewhere, but I honestly couldn't find it. Not to say that it's not delicious. And I think you were mentioning that there's La Michoacana ice cream shop. So
right here in Madison, area. Kent. So, you can,
I think that's
check
a,
it out.
You know, and definitely, you know, you can, I encourage you to go try them. And then if you, there's really so many amazing flavors and they're definitely very interesting. And, you know, if you love them, then you can buy the book and make them at home as well.
Kent, thanks for calling in. We go next to Dave on the line in Madison. Dave, hi.
Hi there. I was just wondering from our guests if, we've at home, we've tried to make, some popsicles a few times and with yogurt and or other dairy base, but we've had a little bit of trouble with crystallizing. And I wondered if your guests had any thoughts on how to avoid crystallizing or kind of a gritty flavor that comes through on popsicles.
But these are like dairy popsicles, Dave?
Yes.
Okay. Any thoughts, Fani?
Yeah, I just have a question for Dave. Is this just particularly with yogurt or... With
yeah,
other...
it was mostly with yogurt.
Yeah, so yogurt definitely, you know, because of the acidity and it doesn't have as much fat as, you know, other dairy, it's going to naturally crystallize. But if you use something like honey to sweeten it rather than other sugars, that always helps. And then also if you use a type of yogurt that is naturally heavier, like a Greek or a Persian yogurt, that's also going to help.
All right. Good luck, Dave.
Dave, thanks for that. And Fani, you walk us through the ingredients in the beginning of your book and a couple that you emphasize. You say Mexican cinnamon and Mexican vanilla. Can you two tell us what the distinction is there with those?
Yeah. So there's different kinds of cinnamon, and Mexican cinnamon is a type of cinnamon also referred to as true cinnamon, and which grows in different parts of the world as well. And it's very different to the one that's most commonly found, you know, that you find. The most common one is called cassia, and that's the one that has a kind of hard shell that's perfectly round. You know what I'm talking about? And that variety, the one that you most commonly found, is a bit spicy, you know, and it's a great cinnamon, don't get me wrong, but the Mexican cinnamon has a very different taste. It's much more floral, a little bit sweeter, and it has, you know, the bark is much thinner. So it's something, you know, if I really encourage people to seek out, because for a recipe like the horchata, you know, where cinnamon plays a big role, it really is going to make a difference. It's still going to be delicious if you're not able to find it, but it's just going to be a very different experience. So I use Mexican cinnamon for everything. And you can, you know, nowadays you can buy it a lot in many places, even online. So I always get whole, and then I grind it myself in like a coffee or spice grinder, and then I sift it. And then when it comes to vanilla, actually vanilla is originally from the Americas, and most people, you know, there's some contradiction, but most experts agree that it's from Mexico. So, you know, for me, always I try to support as much of the Mexican ingredients that I can. There has been a shortage, I will say. So, you know, if you're going to use the Mexican vanilla, is also like a little bit sweeter than some of the other ones, just naturally sweeter. It's not as plump as other ones, but it's very concentrated flavor. But there's certainly a lot of really good vanilla from other places like Tahiti and Madagascar, if you can't find it.
We're talking to Fani Gerson, author of Mexican Ice Cream, Beloved Stories and Beloved Recipes and Stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Talking about ingredients, Fani, you talked about the regional ingredients of Mexico. You're operating out of New York now. Have you done some experimenting? Have you used regional foods from up there to come up with new Mexican-style ice cream flavors?
Yes, I mean, that's a very, very good question, because when I first started out, I really wanted to do flavors that you could only get in Mexico, right? But we have a lot of amazing fruit here that doesn't grow in Mexico, or the varieties are different. Like the stone fruit here is amazing. And in Mexico, it's not as varied as it is here. So I said, well, you know, instead of just being so stubborn and wanting to get to do just flavors that you get in Mexico, especially as a chef, you know, you want to use the local produce as much as possible. But it's really, you know, Mexican cuisine is about that. It's about, you know, that's a very important aspect, is to highlight what grows in the area. So there is one of my favorite things, and I have a recipe in the book, is I have it as a topping, but I use it as a mix-in as well. It's these apricots, roasted apricots with guajillo chili. It's so good. And then I just mix it inside, you know, a sour cream ice cream that I make here at the shop. And that's one of my, you know, one of my favorites. We also get amazing blueberries and raspberries. And so we make a hibiscus raspberry paletas and sorbet. Mm. So you're always, you know, that's amazing. And even herbs like verbena, that's something that we don't have in Mexico, but we have similar things. So we do like a lime paleta, which is very traditional in Mexico, but then it has like a verbena syrup and strawberries that taste very different than the ones we have in Mexico.
You've got a recipe that might surprise some people, rose petal ice cream. I've had rose water, and I've gotten to love like lavender brownies and lavender, you know, beverages, but I've never seen rose petal ice cream. What is that like?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, one of those. It's I think with anything floral, it's very acquired taste, but it's a very celebratory one. And I think the important thing is to, you know, to source roses that don't have any pesticides or anything like that, because, you know, it's not good for you, but also the flavor is not going to be there. So it's a very lovely, subtle flavor. The recipe also has some almonds, and that just has a slight nutty flavor. And I think it's a great recipe to make, you know, for Mother's Day or Valentine's Day or something like that. It's really lovely.
Now, I don't want to start any fights here, but suppose somebody was listening and thinking, okay, I'm thinking about traveling to Mexico. I want to make sure I get some good ice cream. Oof. If there's one region of the country they should make sure they get to get great ice cream, where would you send them?
That's a very difficult, you ask me all these difficult
questions.
Hey,
we ask the tough questions here.
You do ask the tough questions. I would say Oaxaca is a good place to start, because there's amazing ice cream and it's accessible, because there's a lot of regions where it is, but you have to kind of travel a bit to get to the different places. But Oaxaca is a concentration of amazing ice cream and sorbet right in the center.
Well, it looks delicious, Fani. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
That was Fani Gerson, a chef and nationally renowned expert on Mexican sweets. Her new cookbook is called Mexican Ice Cream, Beloved Recipes and Stories. And you can find some of her recipes for making your very own Mexican-inspired ice creams, sorbets, and toppings at WPR.org. Or you can also check the Central Time Facebook page.
You own an ice cream maker. I don't. I keep thinking, no, it's just going to take up space. This book almost is putting me over the edge to find.
I have to put in a plug for ice cream makers. It was a wedding gift, so we didn't spring for it ourselves. But I have to say, it's one appliance that I say has more than paid for itself for someone else who paid for it. But it's worth it.
It's August, far from the holiday season, and the last thing on your mind right now is probably fruitcake, and yet.
And yet. Fruitcake is in the news, and not just any old fruitcake. It's a very old fruitcake. A conservation group in Antarctica found a fruitcake in an early exploration hut. They think the cake is about 100 years old.
Explorer Robert Falcon Scott, the famous Scott of the Antarctic, apparently brought that fruitcake and left it behind before heading into the interior of the continent. He and his team ultimately never returned.
Something poignant about that, a leftover frozen fruitcake of the Scott expedition, I should say. And the New Zealand Conservation Group, they say they're going to keep the fruitcake in its original location in that hut as part of their effort to preserve Antarctic history. And they report that the cake is in excellent condition and looks and smells almost edible.
Just like a fruitcake made this year. Almost looks and smells almost edible.
I have a feeling, though, if you were in Antarctica and you were really hungry, I bet the fruitcake would start to look a little bit more delicious.
However, at Antarctic temperatures, it might be even harder and more difficult to chew and denser than, you know, that holiday fruitcake that everybody's been giving each other, maybe for the last 100
years. You have to wonder, though, did Scott want that fruitcake or did someone give it to him and he thought, oh, gosh,
no,
I guess I have to lug this fruitcake on the expedition.
But then he left it at the hut.
Yeah.
We'll never know.
We'll never know.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.